The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, the government shutdown is about to enter its fourth week with no end in sight. The president's determination was on display Tuesday evening.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border.
We'll hear from John Cornyn, senior senator from Texas, on how a leader from our largest border state views the border security debate.
It's hard, I think, for us to comprehend the mindset of people who simply turn a blind eye to the drugs, to the human trafficking and the illegal immigration, the gangs, the other criminal activity that comes across our border, and just act like, well, this is not a big deal.
And a close-up on how critical the decision on U.S. troop withdrawal from Syria is going to be.
The United States is not repeating the enormous strategic mistake of 2011 and bugging out of the region.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com. The tension in our nation's capital is palpable. Last Tuesday night, following three-plus weeks of government shutdown, President Trump gave his first Oval Office speech since taking office.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border. Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country.
The president went on to make his case poignantly and presidentially.
This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart and a crisis of the soul. Last month, 20,000 migrant children were illegally brought into the United States, a dramatic increase. These children are used as human pawns by vicious coyotes and ruthless gangs. One in three women are sexually assaulted on the dangerous trek up through Mexico. Women and children are the biggest victims by far of our broken system. This is the tragic reality of illegal immigration on our southern border. This is the cycle of human suffering that I am determined to end.
The recent migrant caravan came to Tijuana, the Mexican border city just south of San Diego. That has focused the media on California's border. But the Texas-Mexico border is the longest by far of any American state's border with Mexico. My Salem colleague Mark Davis, who hosts on 660 The Answer in Dallas, spoke with Texas Senator John Cornyn about his thorny border security problem. Texas may have more to lose than most if no deal is brokered.
Where do we stand on any kind of shutdown talks?
Well, the president's willing to deal, but obviously he's not going to walk away or end up empty-handed. But so far, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have been unwilling to negotiate. My experience, Mark, is that, you know, these hard problems we have to confront up here, if people actually are willing to negotiate in good faith, there is a way to solve the problem or at least address the immediate need for an outcome. We do it all the time up here, but Nancy Pelosi, I think, is clearly concerned about her even more radical base of her support in the House of Representatives. So she was saying now that the wall was immoral, even though Democrats supported the Secure Fence Act of 2006 that called for 600 miles of fencing along the southwestern border. So it just demonstrates how far they've come and how unwilling they are to meet the president halfway.
And that is their gamble. The president's gamble is that while a shutdown may not be quote unquote popular, meaning 50.001% think it's great. Nobody thinks a shutdown's great, but certainly more than 50, maybe more than 60, maybe more than that, believe in the stronger borders that the president wants.
Well, that's right. And somehow there's this disconnect. I mean, coming from Texas, like you and I do, it's hard, I think, for us to comprehend the mindset of people who simply turn a blind eye to the drugs, to the human trafficking and the illegal immigration, the gangs, the other criminal activity that comes across our border, and just act like, well, this is not a big deal. I do not understand it. But somehow that's where the Democratic Party is today. And this is the crowd that calls for the abolition of ICE, which is the law enforcement organization that enforces our immigration laws. So they've just gotten very much more radical than they have even before, and forgotten that the bipartisan border security measures that they've traditionally supported in the past and now seem to have abandoned.
We should be vigilant about every dollar that we spend. That's what, but so here's that's my entry ramp to the following: $5.6 billion. Hasn't the government wasted $5.6 billion since you and I got up this morning?
No doubt. There is a way to try to combine these resources and do what the president wants to do in terms of physical barriers at hard-to-control places, and to do the technology that we need to do, and to provide the staffing that the Border Patrol needs in order to detain people and to interdict illegal drugs coming across the border. And there is a way to make sure that that money is spent efficiently and we're able to maximize each dollar. But right now we seem to be caught up in this silly game of semantics over what's a wall, what's a fence, what's a levee wall, what's a barrier, a vehicle barrier. And the truth is we need some combination of barriers, of technology and personnel, depending on where you are at a given place along the border. And the Border Patrol are the experts and the ones in the best position to tell us precisely what tools they need in order to succeed.
So moving forward, I think a lot of people do not want the president to budge one bit on the $5.6 billion. Right. But there, I've gotten some calls, and I've offered this up myself, that maybe there's an olive branch he can offer in the form of something that would be also very popular about the DACA kids who are here now, not in the future. We've got to cut down. We've got to stem the tide of people dragging their kids across the Rio Grande, putting them in further health danger. My heart breaks over these kids who have died. That is child abuse. So we got to stop that. But if you got a 16-year-old with a 4.0 grade point average dragged across when he was two, and it's no fault of his own, of course we're going to find a way, you know, to not throw that kid out. So
let's give
who doesn't, you know? So let's give the Democrats that. Give us the full $5.6 billion. That sounds great, but I don't think they'd accept it, do you?
No, I don't. I mean, there have been overtures on these so-called DACA kids, now young adults, who came as young children across the border with their parents. Who, in our country, we don't hold children responsible for the mistakes that their parents make, and so they're sort of in a box. But the president has already made a very generous offer to these young adults, and that's been spurned by the Democrats, who I fear they liked the issue to sort of motivate and recruit an angry base and voters at the next election rather than solve the problem. Because if Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were actually interested in solving the problem, this problem could be solved in an hour.
Yeah, because, and again, there's that wonderful video, of Chuck Schumer. It's saying words that Donald Trump could have written about the need for borders and such. I don't know.
It's hypocrisy.
Yeah. So how long does this thing last? I don't know.
I don't know. I think there's going to have to be a sense on the part of Senator Schumer and Ms. Pelosi that their hand is not as strong as they perhaps think it is among their political base. But a lot of this goes back to the reaction to President Trump winning his election in the first place in 2016.
As far as debates go, as suggested by our president, the one that led to this shutdown hasn't amounted to much. Tucker Carlson, whose debates are showcased nightly on Fox News, may be best qualified to judge. Tucker was the guest of my colleague Mike Gallagher.
It takes guts to stand up for what you believe in and kind of be exposed to some of the garbage you and your family have. And yet, when people heard you were going to be on, and people are so supportive of you, and you know that, I know it must be tough sometimes to remember the degree of support that a guy like you has when you're kind of in the barrel.
really. I mean, I'm happily married. I'm not just saying that. I married my high school girlfriend, and my four kids are all gone. They left the house already.
Yep.
And so I spend a lot of time, like, in the dog park with my wife. And, you know, if you're kind of have a happy, placid home life, that stuff means less, I really think. I mean, I wouldn't want to be unmarried or unhappily married. I think I would go crazy. I think I'd be a drunk. I think I'd be super angry, you know, like a lot of people in our business, as you know, as well as I. But no, I have a pretty happy life.
How do you deal with people that don't want to deal with you in good faith?
If you're a lawmaker, your number one priority has got to be doing what's best for the country. And you may want to defeat your opponent. That's totally fine. You may despise your opponent. That's understandable sometimes. If you care at all about what's good for America, then you're really not in the right job. Like, you shouldn't have power over America. On some level, these people don't seem to be thinking about what's best for the country. I mean, if you really think it's okay that we've got 20 million people whose names we don't know, who are using fake federal documents, living here illegally, if you think that's okay, like, I don't even know how to have a conversation with you. Clearly don't care about the country.
Right. And but don't pretend you do. See, the thing that I loathe is to listen to progressives and many Democrats pretend to care about border security. If you care about border security and you say, but I don't like the wall, why would you oppose a wall? There's, as you pointed out last night, there's already lots of places along the border where there is a wall. So do you want those walls taken down if you think that's immoral? You don't want to complete the job? What is it? And the truth of the matter is, as you know, it's just a political talking point to try to stop and thwart Donald Trump. That's all this is about.
Well, yeah. And what's infuriating is they're completely for walls. Right. I mean, they live in a world surrounded by walls, but they've also supported walls in all kinds of other countries. Right. They recognize Israel's right to control its borders, not just to keep terrorists out, but to keep economic migrants out from Africa, which Israel does. And by the way, good for Israel. It's up, you know, that's right. Their decision. And it's okay for them to decide to do that. And Nancy Pelosi has no problem with other, and not just Israel, but Tunisia and other countries whose walls we've either funded or approved of. But we're not allowed to protect our own country. So what does that say about how you feel about our country? Because you don't care.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the discussion and sign up for our podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every single day. Coming up, the prospect of withdrawal from Syria.
I'll just say that the expectation is that the entirety of the physical caliphate will be destroyed.
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. This past week, I traveled with Ambassador John Bolton as part of a small group of journalists covering his trip to Israel and Turkey. The high points in Israel were then followed by a day of frustration in Turkey, where meetings with his counterpart and the deputy foreign minister made apparently no progress. There had been some talk that Bolton and President Erdogan of Turkey would meet, but that meeting never happened. An impasse developed. While in Turkey, I was interviewed by Bob France, my Salem colleague in Cleveland. Heard daily on 1420, The Answer.
So here's what Hugh wrote yesterday as a part of that, and I think it's important to get this out there. Of 2011, the United States is not repeating the enormous strategic mistake of 2011 and bugging out of the region. Whatever the details of the U.S. presence, it will remain. It will be deep, and it will be supported by all of the allies in the new Entente, and it will be a bulwark against Iranian ambitions. Bolton, writes Hugh Hewitt of a National Security Advisor John Bolton, confirmed the red line is very much in place with regards to Assad and chemical weapons. If the Syrian dictator doesn't heed the lessons that followed the first two times he dared President Trump to do what President Barack Obama would not do, a lot of options would be on the table. We know that Bob Woodward reported that when Trump ordered a second strike against Assad, then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis withheld some of those options, including targeting Assad, which the president had ordered. We're not going to do any of that, Mattis is reported by Woodward to have said. The message seems clear to both Iran and Syria. the U.S. is reconfiguring. It isn't leaving. In fact, it may be getting even more lethal. There will be no repeat of 2011. Give us the latest. I read part of your piece in the Post yesterday before you came on to kind of give a summary of what National Security Advisor Bolton is doing and what the new strategy is there. Go ahead and tell us what you can.
Well, I've just landed in Ankara, Turkey, where tomorrow the National Security Advisor Ambassador Bolton will be sitting down with President Erdogan to talk about the northern Syria slice in which American troops are presently occupied. And yesterday was an amazing day in Israel, primarily for scenes that people could see everywhere, of John Bolton at the Western Wall, of John Bolton deep in the tunnel complex underneath the historic temple, abreast of the recreation of the temple. No American senior officials ever gone that far in the temple tunnel, and it was sort of significant. Then that night, Prime Minister Netanyahu declared, with John Bolton standing by him, Israel will never leave the Golan Heights. And so all of us reporters, and the seven reporters traveling with John Bolton, and all of us looked up. You know, that's a big deal. And now the question is, okay, the Israelis are 100% with us. Can John Bolton move Erdogan towards a solution that will assure that the Kurds are not slaughtered, that our ISIS is destroyed, and that the key focus in the region, Iran, remains the key focus in the region?
Hugh, when we talk about ISIS being fully defeated, the president declared 2 weeks ago ISIS has been defeated. What does defeat look like?
I'll just say that the expectation is that the entirety of the physical caliphate will be destroyed. That there are still pockets and that the entirety of it has to be destroyed. And then there are questions about what to do with the ISIS fighters that haven't been answered yet, that are prisoners. Do they go to Gitmo? Do they go to Europe? Do they go to Turkey? Do they stay in the hands of the Kurds? But defeat of ISIS means they have no place where they can walk around outside freely flying their black flag and declaring that this is part of the physical caliphate.
The immigration border stalemate, the potential U.S. pullout from Syria, and the partial government shutdown have dominated news of late. One may wonder what's going on with the so-called Russian collusion investigations under the nearly two-year-long tenure of Special Counsel Robert Mueller. My colleague Mike Gallagher caught up with Victor Davis Hanson, author, columnist, and Hoover Institution fellow.
Can we start with this breaking news? Do you think my take is correct that once again we find somebody sort of caught up in the snare of the Mueller investigation, resulting in charges being filed that have absolutely nothing to do with what I believe is a fishing expedition, and that's the Mueller special counsel. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I call it the Mueller two-step. What he does is he surveys sort of all the satellites that are remotely related to Trump. And then he goes after 20 years of their business, whether it's Michael Cohen or Papadopoulos or Manafort or the Russians. And then he looks to see if any – he has what he calls the criminal, and now he just meets the crime. And he does that, though it is related to collusion in the sense that then he meets with him and he says, I'm going to put you, or in case of Mike Flynn, your son in jail, and I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do this. But you can get out of it if you just tell me some stuff that I can use for collusion. Right. And that's why he does all this stuff. So he's basically after collusion, but he can't find any evidence. So he just takes this net like a fisherman, and he gets all these minnows, and he pulls them up, and he says, I'll throw you back in or I'll kill you, depending if you can tell me what the shark is. And that's what he does. And there's, well, I call it the two-step, because while he's doing this, He's setting this precedent of criminalizing all this activity, whether it's perjury or obstruction. And then we have a parallel track that all he incidentally tells us is, well, Comey leaked classified documents. Comey lied to a congressional 245 times, couldn't remember. McCabe has admitted that he's lying. Clapper has admitted to lying under oath to Congress. Brennan has admitted lying under oath. Comey misled a FISA court. And all of that's exempt. So it gives this message that I don't have collusion, but I'm going to leverage people to find out if I can get it by any means necessary. But I'm not interested in all the real crimes that happen, just the potential ones that they involve Trump. And I think everybody's getting sick of him. And I mean everybody, not just the Republicans, but the independents as well.
I'm very proud that this radio show is a place where people can come to escape the relentless drumbeat of Trump-hating media coverage. In fact, if you talk to the average Trump hater and you ask him, well, what kind of year do you think the country had in 2018? The average Trump hater would say, oh, it was just horrible and terrible and, you know, all this drama and all this angst. You wrote a piece at National Review the other day that says, actually, 2018 was a pretty good year. In fact, it was a most successful year for Americans. Can you give us a reality check, Professor Hansen, and walk us through 2018 a little bit?
Well, we have record low unemployment for minorities, but never been this low. I live in a community that's about 80-90% Hispanics. And when I saw that figure of 4.6% unemployment, I thought, wow, that's what's going on, because there's housing going up, there's buildings going up, there's competition. Every town in rural California's got a sign, now hiring, help wanted. And because he's reversed the relationship between the worker and the employer, the worker is in control and the employer's got to hire. We may get a whole year of 3% GDP. We're the largest oil producer in the world now, largest natural gas, second largest coal producer. We have this volatile stock market, but it's still about 400,000 points higher than when it came in. We look abroad. We've made some progress with North Korea. We're out of that awful Iran deal, the Paris Climate Accord. We met the expectations of it much better than most nations, but we're not in that sham. Whatever it is, we're making progress, restoring deterrence abroad, and yet the average person is much better off, and that's not palatable to the left. So it's the same old Trump is a racist, he's a xenophobic, a nativist, he's a homophobe.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
She's definitely a symptom, without a doubt. No. I think she's a symptom. But that doesn't mean she's harmless. You have to make that distinction. Mm-hmm. Just because something is a symptom does not mean that she's harmless. And she must be thwarted and she must be challenged.
Charlie Kirk weighs in on the damage being done by American academia when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Charlie Kirk launched Turning Point USA, the National Conservative Youth Organization, when he was 18 years old. Its purpose was and is to win the culture war, or at least win some ground back that has been lost on our high school and university campuses. Mr. Kirk was recently the guest of my New Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka, who is nationally syndicated by Salem Media.
There was no coverage in the mainstream media of the biggest event of its kind. Is that correct?
Yeah, very little to none. In fact, a news site that I'm not going to even give them dignify, you know, this great airspace with saying their name, but a news site said Donald Trump Jr. addressed dozens of students.
Are you serious?
I kid you not. I kid you not. Wow. And it was the largest ever gathering of conservative student leaders in the history of the country. All 50 states represented. We had 9 countries in attendance, which really goes to show this is a fight for Western civilization. And for your listeners that don't know, it was our Turning Point USA annual student action summit. And we had Candace Owens speak and Jordan Peterson and yourself and Don Jr., Laura Ingram, all-star lineup. But it takes effort to ignore that kind of a convocation. It really does.
Can you explain to this audience why you created Turning Point USA? And please check it out, tpusa.com. Why did you create this entity?
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. So I started it 6.5 years ago. We are a national conservative student organization that fights for free markets, limited government, and the Constitution. But really, our big picture vision, and it's developed in recent years, is we want to win the American culture war. And we understand we're not going to be the only piece that's necessary, but we are a pretty important one, focusing on the universities, focusing on the high schools, focusing on students that are being indoctrinated to hate the greatest country ever to exist. And yet the universities are teaching students anger and resentment that they live in this country.
nobody knows the millennial generation and its challenges better than Charlie Kirk, good and bad. We had this 60-minute interview with Ocasio-Cortez. I haven't decided. Do we take this person seriously? Is she a threat to our democracy, or is she just laughable? Where do you draw the line, Charlie?
Well, so look, I tried to warn some groups I spoke to a couple of years ago that in 2018 and 2020, you were going to see younger, more diverse versions of Bernie Sanders. And people kind of laughed. I said, no. I said, the universities are always a harbinger of what's to come. Now, I don't know her personally, but I know the type of individual that she is. I deal with thousands of them every single week, Sporka. And I deal with these kind of college activists that are constantly wrong, yet never in doubt. And what makes her so lethal is that she almost goes completely and totally unchallenged for her ideas. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Anderson Cooper. I actually thought he did okay. I thought he actually did one of the first forms of real journalism I've seen him do in months, where he asked her questions like, how are you going to pay for it? Well, this is kind of a new change of pace, because he himself is not as radical as she is. I mean, she is a true Bolshevikian Marxist that, in her own words, she's a radical. And so this absolutely must be taken seriously. She's only a symptom, though, of a broken culture. And especially the universities. You know, they asked her in one of the interviews, well, where'd you learn all your ideas? And she said, well, in college. And right. So then she goes to college, gets no skill set whatsoever to find any sort of job, lives in a completely Democrat area with Democrat city council and Democrat state representatives and Democrat mayor, with rising utility rates, rising housing rates, really high taxes and low job opportunities. And she says, well, it's really hard. And I deserve something for free. And then she kind of falls into this socialist mindset, which a lot of young people are doing. And so, look, she's.
But is she a symptom, or is she more than that?
No, she's definitely a symptom, without a doubt. No. I think she's a symptom. But that doesn't mean she's harmless. You have to make that distinction. Mm-hmm. Just because something is a symptom does not mean that she's harmless. And she must be thwarted, and she must be challenged. And Candace Owens, who's brilliant, as you all know, I mean, she's a very effective voice, and she's our communications director at Turning Point USA. She's been challenging her, and they're both the same age, and they're both of, you know, they're both women of color, and they both grew up in poverty in the same tri-state area. And they're both able, you know, so they can't essentially out-identity politic each other.
Right.
Right. And Candace has said it best, which is we have to stop treating her as if she's an infant. I mean, she's a 30-year-old woman who now represents 800,000 constituents. When she says something on 60 Minutes, like she said, oh, well, I don't really care about being factually correct. I care about being morally right. Are you kidding me? This is what the Marxists have always said.
Right.
Facts mean nothing.
Right.
All that matters is how you feel.
Yeah.
It matters if you feel good.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
The problem with this, of course, is that often when a child goes through this, usually they have other underlying psychiatric problems. And the problem is when you turn around and affirm, when you're a doctor and you're supposed to safeguard, you know, these minors, and instead what you affirm their diagnosis, they will not get treatment for the underlying medical problem.
The ravages of gender dysphoria and ROGD. The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Abigail Schreier is a lawyer and a cultural observer writing for The Federalist. Recently, she penned a piece for The Wall Street Journal, which could have shock value for the most cynical of readers. Her topic, rapid onset gender dysphoria, or ROGD. She recently spoke with my colleague, Dennis Prager.
There are so many lines in your piece about this rapid onset gender disorder that are worthy of noting. And one of them is, I want to get this straight in my mind. Where do the pediatricians of the country stand on these matters?
That's a great question. Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Pediatric Endocrine Society have now moved to affirmative care. That means they believe their job is to affirm the self-diagnosis of minor children. So minor child will now come in and say, I'm gender dysphoric, or actually they will usually say, I'm transgender, which is not a medical diagnosis, but that's what they will say. And they believe the job of the pediatrician is to say, yes, you are. I will now use your name that you supply and your pronouns. The problem with this, of course, is that often when a child goes through this, and I'm not talking about young children, but we're now seeing a huge rise in this, a really astronomical rise in this among adolescents, which we had not seen ever before. Usually they have other underlying psychiatric problems. And the problem is when you turn around and affirm, when you're a doctor and you're supposed to safeguard, you know, these minors, and instead what you affirm their diagnosis, they will not get treatment for the underlying medical problem. And often they have one. They have a lot of anxiety. They have a lot of depression.
I'm thinking about how yet another institution in society has been ruined by the left. And that is medicine, specifically here with pediatricians. I know that there are dissenting voices among pediatricians. There's a small group that has another name. Are you familiar with that?
I think you mean the College of Pediatricians?
Yeah, whatever it's called. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I'm familiar with it. I don't know much about it, but I do understand as a lawyer that when you change the standard of care for all these pediatricians, what you're doing is signaling to them liability. You're opening them up to liability if they don't follow their standards of care. It's a really effective means of silencing the medical community.
Right. So what, an 8-year-old girl comes into the pediatrician's office and says, Doctor, I'm really a boy, and he can't say, you know what, so many little girls have gone through that stage, you're actually a girl, everything will be all right. If he says that, he's open to a legal action. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the standard of care I believe the change in the standard of care will open them to liability. But here's the thing. It's not even that we're seeing it with the 8-year-olds. Gender identity disorder, what we now call gender dysphoria, used to be something that occurred in a tiny fraction of a percentage of the population.
Abigail Schreier is my guest. One of the few people, aside from me, I will fully acknowledge that, who was sounding the alarm about the war on children in the United States of America, waged by every institution virtually, religious institutions, as you point out in your column, and the medical profession, the psychotherapeutic profession, and, of course, the media in creating, really.
And public schools.
Oh, yes, and public schools.
Public schools, can't forget public schools, because they are aggressive. Curricula are being rewritten. Planned Parenthood.
Give us an example. What does it mean a curriculum is rewritten?
So there are several ways. In California, we now have Positive Prevention Plus, their new curriculum, which is rewritten to, first it presents as biology. So what we'll teach children about is their health curriculum and things like sexually transmitted disease, which of course is factual and medical and scientific. And in this course, they will also teach things about how, you know, gender identity is in your head, and that, for instance, a boy can essentially have a girl's brain, that this idea of identity is in your head. There's, of course, no basis for this. There's no sense that, you know, obviously the...
Why is this even taught? I don't understand. Where is it taught? In a biology class? Where is it taught to a fifth grader?
It's taught in their health program that they now teach in schools. They have them, you know, throughout the country, they're teaching this. Obviously, Fairfax County is teaching this, but there's also been efforts to move this into other areas of the curriculum. So there's been a huge effort in public schools to move, more transgender-sensitive material into history, because they say they've been excluded from history.
How do you do that? I'm sorry. I know about that, but I understand. Well, you could say, oh, so this inventor was really gay, or here are blacks that you haven't heard of. Are there really teenage girls having their breasts removed?
Absolutely. And in fact, they are lowering the age of medical consent in California.
Without parents. Without parents.
Without parents.
That's critical.
And I talk
yeah.
to parents yeah. whose daughters, and these are girls, these are, now, this is not traditional gender dysphoria. These are adolescent girls who experience no dysphoria in childhood. And then they go through puberty and they feel uncomfortable in their bodies. And they, somebody tells them, maybe you're really a boy.
That's
maybe
right.
Maybe you are trans.
Right.
And then they can go out and get these treatments.
And no therapist in California can say, you're not a boy.
That's exactly right. And they don't even need a therapist note. They can go to a gender clinic and ask for testosterone, and all they need to do is sign, is give their informed consent, meaning I'm aware of the risks, and I waive, you know, liability. These teenage girls become somewhat hysterical once they discover this community that they think they're a part of. And they're suffering from a lot of anxiety and depression to begin with, so they're desperate to belong. And there are surgeons throughout the country who will even perform the surgery without so much as a psychiatric note, suggesting that this is necessary or a good idea.
Who pays these surgeons?
Okay, that is a good question. First of all, under Obamacare, a lot more of this is covered. So in the universities, a lot of these kids were able to get treatment at very little cost, because the university health plans are covering this. So it's much easier for a kid who's troubled, who's going off to college with some anxiety, to come home with a beard. And that's happening.
For Dennis's entire interview with Ms. Schreier, go to townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Well, there's a rule. If you say that word, you have to do push-ups in the facility. So, you know, we usually give, you know, newbies a free pass, but if you say it twice, you got to do 10 push-ups in the facility.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, the land of the Buckeye Football Report, the Browns always, and the Cleveland Indians when they win the World Series. Not just kidding. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Urban Meyer just led the Ohio State Buckeyes to a resounding victory in the Rose Bowl. And then he retired. As you can imagine, Coach Meyer has shaped the careers of some pretty remarkable athletes. But there is one who changed his life. Here's my colleague, Larry Elder, with Coach Meyer.
All right, Coach, your last game at Ohio State. I know it's a Rose Bowl. I know you won. But how does it feel?
Well, I think the Rose Bowl was a bucket list, something I grew up in Ohio watching in the 70s. You know, it seemed like Ohio State versus USC, darn near every year. Archie Griffin was the only player ever to score in four straight games. And so it was a dream. And we came close many times to getting that game, but we never did. And so to be able to finish my career at Ohio State with a win over an excellent Washington team with a bunch of players I loved to death, it was a perfect night.
Now, Coach, I know you're here in town, and there's a rivalry. I'm born and raised in L.A., big rivalry between USC and UCLA. I thought that was a serious rivalry until I went to Michigan, between Ohio State and Michigan. I don't think there's any rivalry that intense in the whole country.
You know, the one rivalry that I've never been a part of is the Auburn, the Iron Bowl, Auburn, mm-hmm. Alabama. I would love to see that someday, but I can only talk about the Ohio State team up north, because the thing that's amazing, Larry, and you'll understand this because you went there, is that it's hatred, it's dislike, it's competitive, but the R word is so powerful, the respect, and that goes back to that 10-year war with a guy that ended up was becoming a friend, Bo Schembechler, and obviously Woody Hayes.
Right.
It is R. And how do you respect the rivalry? You work on that thing every day. And that's what we've done.
And, Coach, when you and I first talked, we talked on the phone, and you asked me to speak to your players. And I said, Coach, I need to tell you something. You said what? I went to Michigan. And you didn't say anything for almost 20 seconds. I thought something could happen to you. And you said, well, when you come, can you not say that can you say the school up north? And I said, yeah, I can do that.
Well, there's a rule. If you say that word, you have to do push-ups in the facility. So, you know, we usually give, you know, newbies a free pass. But if you say it twice, you have to do 10 push-ups in the facility.
What was coaching Tim Tebow like?
Tim Tebow is a dear friend. I've never met a person like him. I've never met a person who was so strong in his faith, who is his entire being is making someone else's day brighter and who's struggling. And he taught me. He changed my life. And on top of that, he's the toughest guy. And this is a very bold statement. He's the toughest guy I've ever coached.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.